started there all the way. So when I get back home once more, is there I'll end my day.
Courcelette. It seemed but a small village as we stood and gazed over its roofs and the higher ground at the old sugar refinery. The refinery, the ruin shows itself between the great barn and the water tower. We went to the Canadian Memorial, which was on the right just before the village, a beautiful ground with a brown hedge surrounding it. The memorial itself is another one of those, such as the centre of the grounds at Hill 62 and at Passchendaele. We went down the slope into the village. The church is very new and the memorial of the French is nearby. The houses also look quite new, and here and there you see the old cellars and the low ruins. Madame greeted us warmly and was quite eager to talk. She's an original of Courcelette and told us of her life there during the 18 months of German occupation and of seeing a German officer kick his men on parade. The British shells came very near and the Germans were remarkably adept at taking cover. After the people came back to the ruins of Courcelette and started rebuilding, they found many German dead in the cellars where they'd been crushed by the barrage preceding its capture. They were the words spoken by a veteran, a man called Will Bird. He served with the 42nd Battalion, the Black Watch of Canada. And after the war, he wrote his memoirs, which he called Ghosts Have Warm Hands. And the words that I've just spoken were his description of the village of Courcelette in the 1930s when he returned there. So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I call Tales from the Battlefield. And my name is Terry Wenham. And I've just returned from an incredible few days on the Somme when I've been guiding a couple of Australian people. It's their third visit with me to the battlefields of the Western Front. And we enjoyed an incredible weekend. The weather was changeable. We had one beautiful day of sunshine. We recorded this particular podcast in Courcelette. But we uncovered all sorts of new stories and I've recorded several podcasts. I think I've got six in the bag, in the can as they call it, that I'm going to be sharing with you over the next few weeks. Interviews with all sorts of people that we met on the battlefields. And I managed to record interviews with so many of them. It was absolutely fascinating and I learned so much. We continue to learn, don't we? It never ends. So in this podcast, I interviewed a lady called Poppy Mercier and she's a resident of the village of Courcelette, the village that was taken by the Canadians during the first advance of the tanks on the 15th of September 1916. We've featured the story in recent weeks where we've looked at the southern part of the battlefield around Fleurs with the New Zealanders. But this was on the other side of the D929, the main road between Albert and Bapaume. And this is where the Canadians went in. The infantry went in with the support of the tanks. And I spoke to Poppy from the Courcelette British Cemetery and she told me what it was like to live in Courcelette now and the passion that she has. You can hear the passion in her voice as she talks in the interview and we'll play that later on. But let's just go back and read a few more words that Will Bird wrote when he visited Courcelette in the 1930s. He said, "We went on out the sunken road and to Courcelette again. I wanted to have a look at the sunken road there. It is banked as high as your shoulder, and on top you can see the long white lines that indicate old trenches. A farmer came along, riding an immense horse, and asked what I was looking for. He began to talk as soon as I explained, and he told me he'd seen at least 100 bodies taken from that sunken road. When they'd cleaned it and made it wide enough for traffic, they found British and German weapons of all kinds. Bombs, shells, everything. Even a huge cheese under the mounds of shell-piled earth. Only last summer, a boy had his arm blown off by a bomb explosion as he played in the Somme fields, and the farmer had said he'd seen an auto car blown from the road as it detonated a shell. It will be years before they can move with security in the old battlefields, he said. And to a certain extent, that's still the case now. Just standing by the side of the Courcelette British Cemetery, while we were waiting for Poppy, we wandered around in the field there and we found a British Mills hand grenade just lying on the surface there, and a few yards away was a British 18-pounder shrapnel shell just within a few feet of the entrance near the road. You could easily have run over that if it was in the road. And it's a reminder that the battlefield is still giving up its iron harvest, and it will do, as we'll see later on, for many decades to come yet. Even when we're gone, the bombs, the shrapnel, the hand grenades, the bullets, and even the men themselves will still come to the surface for the people that follow us in history. So just before we go any further, just a quick summary, really, of what happened, the Canadian Corps' involvement in the battle. And this was their first involvement in the Battle of the Somme. They'd only arrived on the Somme battlefield a few weeks before. And the village of Courcelette had been fortified. The Germans had plenty of time to do that. It was behind their first and second lines. And they'd built enormous bunkers using the cellars of the houses and the chateau that was there in Courcelette. And the Canadians attacked the outskirts of the village at 6:20 a.m. on the 15th of September under the creeping barrage. The barrage, to a certain extent, went wrong. It lifted 100 metres before the German lines and leaving the advancing men open to machine gun fire. This was a setback, but the attack was an unexpected success. They had the support of several tanks. They took the sugar refinery, the sugar factory. It's no longer there, but close to that is the memorial that Wilbur talked about to the Canadians on the Somme. And the trenches in front of Courcelette fell by about 8 o'clock a.m., just within 2 hours of the attack beginning. And then their commanding officer, a man called Byng, he then had a decision that perhaps no one had made yet so far in the Somme. Should he continue with the attack on the village itself and exploit the advantage of the success that they'd had that morning? And that's what he decided to do. The Canadians advanced almost 2 kilometres to the outskirts of the village itself, but of course, out in the open there, they're sustaining very heavy casualties. They reached the first German-occupied trenches, they attacked with bayonets, and they drove the Germans back into the village itself. Attacking from the right-hand side, the men of the 22nd Battalion split into smaller groups and cleared the village, and the Germans were pushed out of Courcelette by 6:30 p.m. And then they knew that the Germans would counterattack. That's all what they always did, didn't they? That was the German strategy, their tactics. The Canadians were low on ammunition, food and water. They found some German ammunition, which they used. And during that night, the Germans attacked several times. And the next day, the 22nd Battalion alone was down to just 200 men out of their original 900. They had their first meal in several days. And on the 18th of September, 3 days after going into action, the two battalions that had taken Courcelette were finally relieved. But after 4 days of constant counterattacks, just for those two battalions, there were 7,230 men killed, wounded or missing. And it's said that there are over 20,000 casualties in total for the Canadian Corps that attacked during that battle. And I think I read that there was as many as 8,000 of those killed, and incredibly 6,000 of them have no known grave, and they make up the majority of the 11,000 soldiers that are missing, that have no known grave, that are remembered on the splendid Canadian memorial up at Vimy. Over half of those fell in this battle at Courcelette. But don't forget, this was a success. We're going to be talking today about what went right, not what went wrong. And of course, we're going to remember some of those men that died in that battle. Now, obviously, we're going to be quoting a lot from Canadian sources, but also wanted to, and I thought about this whilst I was there, what was it like for the Germans that were facing this onslaught? They'd never seen tanks before, they didn't know they were coming. And these are a few quotes that I found from individual German soldiers that were there. One German man said, "A man came running up from the left, crying, 'A crocodile is crawling around in our trenches.' The poor fellow's nerves had cracked. One said it was a phantom vision, this giant in the light of dawn, its nose rearing up from a shell hole, then lurching on slowly, no doubt, but with a horrid sense of purpose. Now it could be scarcely 100 metres in front of our position." The Germans no doubt tried shooting at them with their small arms fire and machine guns, but the bullets just bounced off these crocodiles, as they called them. Another German said some minutes passed before the Tommies broke into our position, not indeed by a proper assault, but by pushing one another forward. They trod on our dead and wounded. They were reeking of alcohol, and they offered our men whiskey and cigarettes, apparently glad to have been spared having to make a bayonet attack. They asked if we had any more men in our trench, because they'd come under heavy fire from there. They lifted the tent canvases from the funk holes, and what did they see? Dead and wounded. They told us that they were Canadians, old friends from the fighting in Flanders. That made sense. Medical orderlies came up behind and assembled the wounded, friend and foe, together. We were hauled out of the trenches and told to make our way as best we could to the British dressing station. Now, one of the Canadian men that the Germans were up against that day was called Private Lance Catamol, and he was a private in the 21st Battalion, and he wrote a very detailed account of his experiences on the 15th of September 1916 at Courcelette. I'm going to read some of that to you now and we'll see how we go. "We arrived at our jumping off trench with none too much time to spare. This was probably intentional so that we did not have long to wait before going over. We dropped into the trench beside those who were holding it and regained our breath from our tiring walk. My platoon was in the first and last wave in the advance. We crawled over the top of the parapet and lined up in a broad white tape, just discernible in the growing light, immediately in front of the trench and behind the first two waves, which were already in position. It was almost 0 hour. I looked at my wristwatch and we saw we'd had about 3 minutes to go. I never heard our officers' whistles to signal the advance, and I don't suppose they heard them either, because of the terrific crash with which the creeping barrage opened up. Exactly at 6:20 a.m. We started our advance, but had only taken 3 paces when an enemy shell fell exactly in front of me. All I saw was a great fountain of loose earth, of which I received a mouthful, and I was flung on my back. I believe it was only a second or two before I struggled to my feet, thinking I was blown to bits. I felt myself all over, and to my amazement I had no injuries whatsoever. I was simply winded. The shell must have been a dud. At this I started to laugh, which I presume was a sign of nervous relief that I was not hit, and I continued my walk forward." Just thinking about that, someone once said to me many years ago that fate is a funny thing, and that's proof of it, because if that shell had gone off, it would have blown into bits, and he wouldn't have lived the life that he lived after the war, and I wouldn't be sitting here reading his account now. But that's not what happened. The fickle finger of fate allowed him to continue. He then moved on through no man's land. And then he spotted someone that he knew. He says, "I spotted John Robb. He was on his knees, sitting back on his heels, with his arms hanging loosely at his sides. His helmet was off and his face turned to the sky. There was a look on his face, a look of the most joyous astonishment. I foolishly, without realising he'd been hit, shouted out, 'Come on, Rob, what's wrong?' But as I moved round in front of him to his other side, I saw the blood gushing from his neck where he'd obviously been hit in the jugular. I knew he was finished. In any case, we were not allowed to stop to secure companions in our advance, so there was nothing I could do. I'm not a religious sort of chap. I'd find it difficult to write down what I believe in, and I've mixed ideas about the hereafter. But I would give a lot to know what that young soldier saw in the sky as his lifeblood ebbed away." I've looked in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records and John Robb has no known grave. Perhaps he's still there in that field between Poisier and Courcelette, maybe near where the Canadian Memorial stands today. He was never found, he was never seen again, and as we said earlier, like something like 6,000 others, he's remembered on the Vimy Memorial. And then for Catamol, the fighting starts. These young men are now faced, though, with Germans holding up their hands. He says, suddenly we came upon an enemy trench to our left. In keeping with the no prisoners order, and in view of past German treachery, this trench was being mopped up and the occupants eliminated. The trench was already half full of dead enemy, and here and there little columns of steam rose in the cool morning air, either from the hot bloodlet or from the urine I understand is released on the death of any human body. Two Canadians stood over the trench, one on the parapet and the other on the parados, and they exterminated the Germans as they came out of their dugouts. One young German, scruffy, bareheaded, cropped hair and wearing steel-rimmed spectacles, ran screaming with fear, dodging in and out amongst us as to avoid being shot, crying out, "Nein, nein!" He pulled out of his breast pocket a handful of photographs and he tried to show them to us. I suppose they were his wife and children. And it was an effort to gain our sympathy, but it was all to no avail. As the bullet smacked into him, he fell to the ground motionless, the pathetic little photographs fluttering down to the earth around him. Isn't that sad? It really has affected me as I read that then. That's the first time I've read that account. Poor young German, like so many other poor young men, desperately hoping that the Canadians would have pity on him and one day he would be able to go back and see his children and his wife. But that wasn't to happen. And I wonder what happened to his children and his wife. Did they ever get over the death of that young man? We'll never know, will we? We'll never know who he was. But by telling the story here today, we will remember him. We don't know who he was, we never will, but we will still remember him. It must have affected those men as well. They were civilians, of course, in their lives before the Great War. And I know from what people have told me that interviewed these veterans, they never got over this. It played on their minds into old age. Is it any wonder that so many of them didn't talk about it? So Lance Catamol with his comrades, they were now on the site of the old sugar factory which the Germans had fortified, but he said it was nothing but a mass of crushed masonry. He said our company commander, his right arm in a sling and looking very pale, stood on a small knoll looking over towards the village of Courcelette to our left front. Evidently, he'd got to close quarters in taking the German position. Captain Miller was a big man, very silent. The only emotion he seemed to show was a gentle half-smile, and when he spoke to you, you could hardly hear him. When there was the slightest breeze, his commands on parade were lost, but he was brave as a lion. As I was walking with a short fellow on my left and a tall lad named Kelly on my right, a Jack Johnson, which was a German shell, landed over to our left with a terrific roar. A piece of shell casing flew past the heads of us smaller chaps, hitting Kelly in the shoulder, and he let out a yell. As the position had been taken, we were able to do what we could for him. We eased off his equipment and took a clasp knife, which I carried in my right leg putty, and cut the sleeve off his jacket up to the shoulder so we could get at the wound. The piece of shell casing was about an inch thick and a couple of inches square, half buried in the muscle. It was very hot, but I gradually eased it out and dropped it on the ground. I'd already got his field dressing out and undone it, and then I said, "Kelly, this is going to hurt." And I poured a liberal dose of iodine as a precaution against tetanus. He went very white, but took it splendidly. I applied the dressing, and we put him on the road back down a communication trench to an advanced dressing post, and to Blighty, where I saw him many months later. It made me think, as I was just reading that, he said he pulled that piece of shrapnel out and threw it on the ground. I wonder if that piece of shrapnel is still there, and I wonder if one day, maybe it already has, someone's picked it up, a tourist has picked it up and maybe taken it home as a souvenir, as many people do, as my clients did this weekend. As the advance goes on, as they leave the site of the sugar factory, the sugar refinery, and they go to the trenches in front of the village, his account continues. He said, "I saw two of our poor fellows lying half buried at the bottom of the trench, their torsos covered by an earth fall from a shell exploding. Just as they were passing, one body was inert, but the other was still quivering, the result of concussion. I never knew whether the lad got out alive. I also saw the smart German MCO who'd made a break for it lying on the ground with others, already turning yellow. We were led to a network of communication trenches to the east of the refinery where we stayed all night, squatting in the trenches and dozing when we could. I suppose we ate our iron rations when we felt hungry, but I cannot recall doing this." He then says that they dropped down into the sugar trench and filed into the sunken road, and this was free of enemy. It was deserted except for the corpse of a British soldier lying on his back, his head downhill and his legs splayed out. There was no trace of any wound. Strangely, the seam of his trousers crutch was split up and his private parts were displayed. I thought it unkind of the fates to show a brave warrior so bizarrely exposed. As we went further in, however, we found a poor little German hiding in the funk holes. He'd been hit in the head. One eye bounced about on a cord below his chin, and the other socket was empty. The two Canadians who found him could not have been more tender to him, and he was eventually got away down the line. I wonder if he survived, and if he did, he'd have been blind, wouldn't he? Now we get towards the end of his account. It's getting towards night time. He's been fighting all day. He says, "I was standing in the road and looking back towards the sugar refinery when I saw a Canadian officer bareheaded with a blue scarf tied around his head over his eyes and hanging down in front of his face, giving the appearance of a bandit on the films. He was dragging himself along the ground and he could not see. He dropped into the next shell hole. Then he pulled himself out of that and dropped into the next one, and I didn't see him again. When our own platoon corporal came in to visit us, I told him of this happening and he said, 'Well, he must be one of ours. I'll go and have a look for him.' I learned later that he found the officer and he pulled him to safety, receiving a sniper's bullet in his buttocks for his gallantry. Obviously, the blinded officer had no idea where he was and was in fact travelling in the wrong direction. The young corporal that saved him already wore the military medal. He recovered from his wound, only to have his foot blown off later. We were then told that the cavalry would come and break through. No cavalry appeared. No counter-attack developed in our particular section of the sunken road, but there was much activity going on lower down and around the village. Eventually, darkness came, and we were told we would be relieved at midnight. This proved true, and our relief filed into the road. We were led out by a guide back through Sugar Trench. We found this full of wounded, and one poor sergeant lying against the wall of the trench, wounded in the leg, said, 'Mind my bloody foot,' which was terribly difficult to avoid on getting into the trench. He groaned as I unavoidably touched his foot. We were soon out of the trench to make faster time overland. Once we got clear of the sunken road, it now came on to rain slightly, which we found refreshing after the sweating of the day, and we trudged on with the rain coming into our faces." Now, as we keep saying, as we're talking, Catamo and his mates, their objectives had been achieved. They've done everything that was expected of them, but it was at great cost. And he says, as they came out of the line, "Eventually we reached Happy Valley again, and we answered our names on a roll call. There was only about 12 of us left out of the 20 who'd gone forward to occupy the sunken road. They were given a double rum ration, those few survivors. There was plenty of rum to go round, I supposed. And Catamol was actually underage. He shouldn't have been there at all. His mother wrote to the Canadian authorities and he was evacuated from the trenches. And that was his first and last experience on the Western Front." So that's the story. There's some personal accounts. But now let's go over to the Courcelette British Cemetery, where so many of those men are buried. But so many of the men that are buried in Courcelette British Cemetery are unknown. They're beneath headstones that say, "Known unto God." There are now 1,970 Commonwealth servicemen buried or commemorated in this cemetery, but as many as 1,180 of them are unidentified. And it was standing amongst those graves that I talked to Poppy last Saturday afternoon on a lovely warm spring day. So we're now standing, is it Corselet?
It's Corselet
British Cemetery. British Cemetery, yeah. And again, with all these cemeteries around us, we'll talk about the cemetery a bit in a minute, but what can we see? We can see the village of Corselet just below us, which was taken by the Canadians in the Tank Battle of September 1916. And then behind me, I can see the main D929 road that goes from Bapaume down to Albert. And sitting up there, we can see the windmill, site of the Australian windmill, can't we? And the tank memorial opposite, and then the village of Poisier sitting on the highest point of the Somme. And then we turn to the right, and we can see the trees that surround Moquet Farm. And then just beyond that, we can see the flagpoles just on top of the Teepvale Memorial there. I'm here with Poppy Mercier. So tell me, how did you come to be on the battlefields of the Somme then, Poppy?
So I think I've got my parents really to blame for this.
It's always their fault.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So my parents moved out here quite some time ago now. And they're both historians, and they've both always had a great love for certainly military history. So I grew up in this area. I spent many happy summers as a child running around cemeteries like this with my brother.
How old were you then when you came?
So I have been here practically since birth.
Oh, really?
So I was born in the UK.
Yeah.
But my brother and I, we very much grew up out here.
Yeah.
And then I returned to the UK to go to school.
Yeah.
So yes, I have many happy childhood memories of sort of a 3, 4, 5 year old running around cemeteries like this.
And yeah.
It's the sort of thing that you know, certainly then people would go, "Why on earth are you interested by that?" And certainly when I was then at school in England, they'd be like, "Why do you have such a weird fascination for, you know, military history?" And it's like, well, you can blame my parents for that.
Definitely. They do have a big influence on us.
Yeah, and it's never really stopped. I moved back to France nearly 8 years ago now.
Yeah. And you're living in the same house that
I'm living in the same house I grew up in.
Just a few hundred yards from here, isn't it?
It's on this end of the village, and it's my family home, so it's nice to have come back.
Yeah, definitely.
To live here, and I've sort of partially made a business out of it as well, so I do occasionally do some guiding.
Weren't you working at the museum in Albert?
Yes. That was an interim thing. It was really good. That was a really great experience because you meet all sorts of fantastic people.
And now you've got your own business, you were just telling us, with
and
Andrew.
Yeah, and in 2022 I was working for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission as a guide.
Yeah.
And that was in itself a truly fantastic experience and really sort of enhanced my wider knowledge of this area. I never claim to be an expert. I'm not an expert, but I'm an enthusiast more than anything else, and I think that's the most important bit, is the enthusiasm behind it.
Yeah, you can tell that already.
And now I run my own business centralising around the First and Second World War, but oddly in graphic design. So we, as a business, we have two separate businesses. I focus more on things like medical items that would have been used by the army in both wars. And my partner, Andrew, he focuses more on things like vintage stationery and pocket fillers, the kind of thing that troops would have carried with them on a day-to-day business. And that's really boomed as a business because there's a lot of people who are reenactors. But we also provide for things like museums, film and TV as well. So we've had museums buy stuff from us as sort of gap fillers for items that are really hard to find.
So you see your stuff on TV and film?
Yeah, we do indeed. It's really quite something. You sort of put so much work into what you do, and then you get to see this amazing end result. So we've worked on a couple of film projects and some TV projects in the last couple of years, which is really cool.
Great. So here we've come then to Corselet Cemetery here, and I've just had a quick look in a book. Is it something like 2,000? Is it 2,000 burials here?
Several thousand, and most of them are unknown.
They are, aren't they? That's what I noticed as soon as I arrive, and that's because this is a concentration cemetery.
Yeah, so
a lot of these graves brought in from the battlefields.
Yeah, the majority would have come from what they labelled as the Moquet Farm Road Cemetery, which was just up the track from here.
And that's no longer there.
And that's no longer there. You've also got quite a few burials from places like the Red Chateau, which was used by both the Germans and the Canadians as a dressing post in 1916. So they had to build basically a battlefield cemetery next to it in order to sort of keep the dead away from the dressing station. And that whole cemetery itself, which I believe was a couple of hundred burials, was then moved here post-war.
And then plus where they've cleared the battlefields.
Yes,
and
there's a lot that were recovered in sort of early to mid-20s, some of whom were found in such extraordinary circumstances. There are a set of remains that should have been buried into here, but are now buried at the Anglo-French cemetery. At Teepvale, it was essentially a stretcher party who were found just up the road from the cemetery here.
Right.
And it was the remains of two stretcher bearers and a chap on a stretcher.
That they were carrying?
Yeah.
Oh, blimey. And they moved all three of them?
All three of them buried next to each other, all unfortunately unknown.
Right.
But at the time, their sets of remains were designated to go to Teepvale.
One of the 300.
Rather than to come here instead. So. Blimey.
And we noticed, just wandering around before you arrived, and we're seeing quite a few British, but it seems to be mostly Canadian and Australian.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's the irony of the name of this cemetery, the fact it's called Corselet British, but you look around.
They started it off, I suppose, did they?
Yes, it's a whole mix, but the majority that you'll find in here are CEF and Australian as well.
And that's because of the fighting at Moquet Farm and Poisier, and then later on,
around the middle of September,
in the taking of the village of Corselet, your home village.
Yeah.
So if we have a wander around, have you got some individual stories to tell us
about? Yeah, I can tell you. So I've got stories of, there's a couple of interesting men who are buried in here. I've got some as well who served in the area.
Yeah.
So for the period that Corselet was being fought over, it's quite a few VC winners.
Yeah.
And probably one of the most notable is Piper Richardson.
Yeah.
An interesting story. He was a piper in the CEF.
Right, Canadian,
And he really liked piping his men over the trenches and into the battlefield. And for the act during the Battle of to take Regina Trench, he piped his men over. But not just that, he then was assisting in the evacuation of the wounded back to the rear line. And unfortunately, on his last round, he left his bagpipes with one of his friends, and he never came back.
Oh.
So when they decided that he was officially missing in action, they awarded him the VC for his actions that day.
Over there, Regina Trench.
So yeah, so just beyond the cemetery here, Regina Trench runs pretty much.
About a mile, wasn't it?
Yes, it's a long trench and a very important trench. And it runs essentially from where Mouquet Farm is all the way up to the back towards Miremont. It's probably one of the longest German trench lines on the Somme.
Very deep, wasn't it?
Very deep. Very, very well fortified.
Yeah.
In fact, it took 2 to 3 months to actually take the whole ground around.
They took
here.
One part of that trench, didn't they? And then they found that it was barricaded and the Germans were still there.
Yeah, so the initial attack on the sort of start of October 1916, after they'd taken the village a month previous, was to take Regina Trench in its fullest. And they managed it on some scale, but unfortunately the attack wasn't quite so successful because as soon as they got up there, they realised just how well defended the area was. So it was an attack that resulted in, again, lots of casualties and not quite as successful as they were hoping.
They had to get through Desire Trench, was it?
And it was through Desire Trench as well, which again was very heavily fortified. So they quickly found that they needed to scale back. And the Canadian Corps, certainly the 2nd and 3rd divisions of the Canadian Corps, had been here on the Somme for 3 months. And they had just been practically eliminated by that point. There were very few originals left.
And we see photos of them coming out the line, literally covered in mud from head to foot.
Helmets missing, you know, the trousers in scraps, boots falling off. It was such such a horrendous battle. But it was probably deemed as one of the most successful attacks in the area because they took managed to take so much ground. And it was the Canadian 4th Division that came in sort of early November 1916. And they were the ones along with the 52nd Division who actually took Regina Trench by early November.
We talk about divisions, but this is individual men's bravery. Yeah, people like Piper Richardson. What happened to his body, do we know?
So he was missing until about 1920, and when they were doing all the battlefield clearance around here in the early 20s, they found his remains very close to where he fell. Around Regina Trench, and he was amazingly successfully identified at the time, and then he was reburied, and he's now buried in Adenac Cemetery, which
is
one of the three
Corselet
cemeteries.
Yeah.
So he's with all of his comrades.
Yep.
But his bagpipes went missing after the First World War because he handed them to a comrade.
Yep.
And then somehow they ended up in the hands of a Scottish chaplain.
Okay.
And the chaplain, after the war ended, went back to his job, which was as a teacher. He was a teacher in a private school. And he took the bagpipes with him.
Okay.
And at some point in the 1990s...
As long as that? They were disappeared for all that long? 80 odd years?
In the 1990s, a family were being given a tour around the school. And they said, that's really bizarre, because those bagpipes in that display case, they're a really specific tartan of a Canadian Scottish clan.
Yeah.
And then they said, we had no idea, do you know which? And he said, funnily enough, I think it's the Richardsons.
Really?
So they contacted...
That meant they wanted to be found, these bagpipes. Yeah.
So they contacted the Richardson family, who confirmed that yes, they were in fact Piper Richardson's bagpipes.
What happened to them then?
They are now in his local museum.
They've gone back
home. In Canada. Yeah.
What a wonderful, incredible.
I know.
So there we go. Piper Richardson and his bagpipes are lost.
Yeah.
And they're both found.
And both found again. In such amazing circumstances.
There's a chance of a million, isn't
it? It really is.
But that means it's meant to happen, doesn't it?
And they believe when the bagpipes were first discovered in this school in the 1990s, they think they still had bloodstains.
Really?
Yeah, probably not his.
No.
But from where he'd been helping to ferry the wounded backwards.
Yeah, he'd been carrying his bagpipes on his back.
Most likely.
His bagpipes are not light either,
No, and he wouldn't have been armed either because it's obviously too busy playing the bagpipes. I mean, the chances are that as he was piping the rest of the men over the front line, they probably wouldn't have heard it.
No.
But it's seeing that figure,
going straight on,
and you know that everything will be fine if you follow him.
Yeah.
It was a great morale booster. I mean, even if you into the Second World War, you know, pipers were.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless
we stand here now, it's like late afternoon and the daffs are out. Daffodils have come out, spring flowers. There's the odd Canadian flag, the odd Australian flag. But what I notice now as the sun is starting to go down is look at the shadows.
It's remarkable.
In front of the graves, because it looks to me. I always think when I see the shadows like that, like the soldiers themselves are standing there.
It really does bring these beautiful silent cities to life.
Mm.
And I'm lucky in the fact that I get to see this the whole year round.
You never get fed up with it though, aren't you? Because it all looks different, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, we had the most horrendous snowfall in January.
Yeah.
And it just transformed this place into this silent but stunning landscape. Mm. And you were coming out and you were looking at the headstones and they each had a thick sheet of ice over them.
Huh.
And it was like they were glowing almost.
I
it
bet.
Was remarkable. And then you get to this time of year where, yes, suddenly the sun is out all the time, the flowers are coming out, the grass is getting greener.
Yeah.
And it never on the same day it will never look the same.
No.
So from first thing in the morning to last thing at night, they will always look different.
Yeah.
And because we're so high up where we are, the sunsets from this area are stunning.
Mm.
And actually looking around, you can see why the Germans favoured this area so much.
Mm.
We have a particularly tall church. So, of course, the first thing they did in 1915 is blow
the
spire off and use that as an observation post. Yeah. And certainly from up there, you could see practically everything.
Mm.
It was quite remarkable.
Even from just standing in the cemetery, as I said.
Exactly.
We've got a 360-degree view of the battlefield, haven't we?
Well, essentially, because from here you can see the tank starting off point where the tank memorial on the border between Courcelette and Pozières is today.
And where we're standing then is right in the direction of where those tanks, some of the tanks were heading. I know it was over a large piece of ground, wasn't it?
So specifically here you had six tanks from C Company.
Yep.
It was 1-6. The first three, their objective was to get into the village of Courcelette.
Yep.
Unfortunately, they all ditched or were destroyed before they could actually successfully get into the village.
So they got over the start line.
One broke down, one ditched into a tank, and one got hit.
Right.
This is the problem when you're looking at things like the Mark I tank. Whilst the psychological effect of having them on the battlefield was immense,
they're not reliable.
In practicality, they just weren't reliable.
They rushed them into action.
Yeah, they were so desperate, I think, to have this great machine to sort of turn the tide of the war. The water tank. The other half of the company were then tasked to take the sugar factory, which was another key German stronghold.
Up on the main road.
Up on the main road. And amazingly, out of the three that were sent up there, only one broke down.
Right, yeah.
The other two, so you have C5 and C6, but the only two successful tanks here on the first day.
Right.
Actually managed to almost make their way back to their starting off point by the end of the
day.
There is a photo of C6 coming back down the main road at the end of the next morning when the area had been cleared and the prisoners had been taken.
So then did the infantry then, the Canadian infantry then follow those tanks then
through these fields? So the idea was you had the 2nd and 3rd Canadian Divisions under the command of the Canadian Corps of General Byng. And Byng himself was very famous, but very new to the Western Front.
Yeah.
He'd spent a lot of time, he'd just come back from being at the Suez Canal and looking after the area there.
It's a bit different to here then.
Very different. And he'd been in charge of the evacuation at Gallipoli as well. Right. So you can imagine he's suddenly gone from somewhere like Gallipoli in the Suez
to different fighting ground, different
conditions and very different enemy.
Yeah.
And I think here was really the point where he could prove how good a leader he was. Mm. The other remarkable thing of that day was it was the first major use of the creeping barrage. But the problem was they lifted it about 100 metres too early, and Byng suddenly had to make this great decision, what do I do now? Because suddenly all my troops were exposed. So
he's too far ahead.
The barrage is too far ahead. And it would, in practice, had it all gone very wrong, it would have been a disaster. Mm. However, miraculously, actually lifting it early gave them such this element of surprise on both sides that it oddly worked and actually bolstered the attack into the village. So you had the 22nd and the 25th battalions of the CEF coming up behind the tanks alongside the PPCLI.
Either side of that minor road that we just drove across these fields here.
Yeah. So they were basically, they were stationed along them at almost the main road. The trench was just in front of it.
Yeah.
Half of them were their objective was to take the village, and the other half was to try and get towards the sugar factory, but also to take Sugar and Candy Trench, which were the two main trenches running
in front of the village.
Yeah, running from the sugar factory and up into Courcelette village itself.
And they fortified the remains of the sugar factory as well.
Yes, they had. Most of Courcelette was very fortified because, of course, the Germans had been here since December 1914. They'd had all this time, especially if you look up Teepval as well, where that area was so well fortified. Mm. It was very much the same down here. Mm. They'd had the time to sort of plan where is the best place to have machine gun posts or mortar posts, pillboxes and things like that. So I think it was quite a surprise to see how fortified everywhere was.
Well, what's different here, though, in this attack, is that Courcelette is actually low down, isn't it?
They're
attacking downhill, aren't they? But it's still giving the advantage to the Germans because they've been here so long, haven't they? Yeah.
And then within the first 12 hours of the attack being launched, they'd actually taken the village.
Within 12 hours?
By 6:30 that night, the village was in Allied hands.
Yeah.
And the Germans had been pushed back towards Regina Trench and back towards Miramar.
And we're talking counter-attack then?
So for the following 4 days, there were numerous counterattacks.
This is the German strategy, isn't it? As soon as you lose a position,
absolutely counterattack it. Yes, and you had many young junior officers who, again, it was their first foray into the fighting, especially for the 22nd Battalion of the CEF, the Van Durs. It was their first major battle of the First World War. So they were very new, and they're up against old guard reserve divisions. So you can
imagine, very experienced soldiers.
Yeah, men who had spent the last 2.5 years learning this landscape like the back of their hand.
They knew every inch of this place. Yeah.
But yes, the Vandas really showed how good a unit, a fighting unit they were. And thanks to Byng as well, who had reformed the Canadian Corps.
Which is fantastic leadership, isn't it?
Exactly.
He was loved by his men.
They even called themselves Byng's boys because they loved him so much. Yeah. And of course, later on,
he's taken out to Vimy.
Exactly. And he comes after the war. It was something like the Duke of Vimy or something. Yeah. He was given some great title after the war.
And that's very unusual, isn't it?
It is. It is. He was so
the First
so
World
well.
War generals,
he was so well loved and adored by his men. But it was his quick thinking decisions that day, I think, that really helped.
They fought off the counterattacks then.
Yes.
They still held
after 4 days, they had unfortunately lost about 7,000 men, 7,000 casualties,
wounded, dead, and killed, prisoner of war, maybe some of
them.
Yeah.
But it's really within those next couple of days you start to see the heroism coming through.
Individual heroism.
So, for example, one story that I find remarkable, you have a Private Carr of the 49th Battalion.
Yeah, 49th Canadian.
Yes, Edmonton Battalion.
Yeah.
And he was tasked with running grenades up and down the trench to resupply his comrades further up the line. So as he was running these things, all of his own accord, he felt that he had to do this. He got to one area of the trench and discovered that the Germans thought.
This is the trench that they've taken.
This is the trench they've taken. He gets to a portion of the trench that I think he realised hadn't actually been taken yet.
Oh.
But even weirder, the Germans surrendered.
They were scared of him because they saw him with all these bombs.
Yeah, and not just that, he was taking pot shots at them. And they assumed this company had turned up.
Yeah.
And it was just him. And it was just him. And he took nearly 70 prisoners.
Took them back?
Yeah.
Was he rewarded for that?
He got the VC for that.
Excellent. And he survived to tell the story?
And I think he died in 1963.
Oh,
so
wow.
But not just that, he had his hand blown off.
What, that day? During that, yeah. Oh, my word.
Yeah, during his actions in taking something like 250 metres of ground on his own. And then taking prisoners.
What rank was he?
He's private.
He's a private.
He's a private.
My word. And this is all happening. All these stories we're talking about. We're stood here today. It's so peaceful. We keep saying this all day today, haven't we?
Yeah.
So peaceful today. The wind's not blowing. And it's early spring day. And you just cannot imagine. Haven't you had your hand blown off? All the ligaments and blood.
Yep.
And he still
managed it.
It's bad enough if I scratch my finger, I make a noise.
With one rifle and just himself, he took, I think, 69 prisoners.
And carrying all those bombs, which are heavy.
Yep.
And we found a bomb, a British Mills bomb, just over there in the field. You know, that might have been one he was carrying.
But it's stories like that that fascinate me. It's really when you get into the individuals, you start to realise just how amazing it was, and the courage and the bravery.
Ordinary men
who in any other life could have been a factory worker.
And they were.
Exactly. You know, after the war, so many of these men just went home and continued.
Yeah, I didn't talk about it. There's so many of them, apart from to each other. What else have you got here? Have you got any men buried around us?
So, unfortunately, a lot in here you'll find will be unknown.
Yeah,
a
soldier of the Great War, known unto God. And then we see some Canadians, and we're not even sure when some of these have died. Look, 15th to the 17th.
This is the problem, because the counterattacks were relentless.
Yeah, so they're not quite sure.
And the other problem with here is the area was taken again by the Germans during the spring offensive.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of the ground that they had lost
in
1916, they just swept back in and took it again, like most of the Somme.
They went through here in a day, didn't they?
Yeah.
1918, and of course we came back in New August.
Yep.
And you've lived here for so long, when you've been walking around the fields, have you found anything unusual?
I've been very lucky that, you know, I know a lot of the farmers in the village, and they're quite happy for me to go, certainly when it's like this, and it's freshly
ploughed,
and there's nothing in, they've not cropped anything yet.
Yeah.
They're happy for me to go walking, and I think they appreciate the fact that these things get cleared out of
they haven't got to do it then, have they?
Exactly. And I, you know, you tend to find it's the small things that fascinate me. And I found coins before. I found toothbrushes.
Have you? That's personal, isn't it?
Yep. So service issue ivory handled toothbrushes.
Right.
Unfortunately, never found anything named, which is
No.
For a long time, certainly when I was a teenager, if I was walking up here on the corner in the mid to late 20s, is where they burnt all the wooden crosses.
All the wooden crosses,
from here and from Regina Trench.
And they've still got the metal tags.
And
metal
for a long time, you
them.
Could find all the metal tags.
Really?
And I think I must have found about a dozen or so.
You still got them then?
Yeah.
Oh, well done.
Some of them I've actually managed to identify to men who are buried in either cemetery.
Which is quite something.
Because sometimes you'd get fragments of service numbers
or
fragments of names, and they were unusual names, which was great because it then meant you could go and easily identify
them.
So it's this annual school. You go walking, you find shrapnel balls, chunks of shrapnel.
Found a load just now.
303 cartridges and all sorts of things. So.
It'll still be coming through for many, many, long after we're gone, won't it?
I believe the German, the Belgian Deminage Service, so like the French, they deal with the ordnance up around Ypres.
Yep.
They believe it's going to take another 150 years.
150 years. You asked me yesterday, didn't you? And I wasn't sure.
Remember.
I knew it was
think that's a generous estimate as well.
Whatever happens, we won't see it.
No.
We won't see it happen.
It's the fact that we're now getting to 110 years
on. It's frightening, isn't it? That's in five minutes. It's a centenary.
Oh, tell me about it. But it's the fact we're getting to 110 years on and we're still finding so much in the fields. And in fact, we're still finding remains as well.
That was my next question. Have they found any remains around here?
Quite a few.
Do they find them?
So often it's when farmers are doing crop rotations and ploughing, you'll bring up the
bones.
Odd bones.
Yeah.
Typically then the police would be alerted, and then if they deemed it to be old enough, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission come out and remove the sets of remains. these days, they are, if there is a viable candidate, they will try and DNA test them. The Canadians work really hard to try and DNA test as much of it as they can.
Yeah, we heard this.
Because they have the funds to be able to do these things, and they have a really great dedicated
team. And they care.
The British government definitely care, and the MOD really do try their best, but of course they're limited with
limited funds
and how much they can do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it comes down to, is there anything personal found with the remains? If there is, excellent, we can then try and use that to track family and then try and get a DNA sample. But even then, it's really complicated because it has to be maternal DNA. You can't have, or it's far more difficult to try and match DNA from a paternal line.
Right. Oh, right. I didn't know that.
Because I have to match it. It's the mitochondrial maternal DNA.
What? We're now using big words. This is the biggest word we've used on Tales from the Battlefield.
Excellent.
Say that again.
Mitochondrial maternal DNA.
I thought that's what you said.
It's a very, very complicated thing. I've been very lucky that I've managed to speak to Dr. Sari Lockyer, who is one of the heads of the Canadian recovery team. And being able to talk to her about these things. So yes, it's the complicated process. It's not as simple as taking a DNA sample and then matching it against something else. It's a far more complicated process. And in fact, yesterday they announced that after 11 and a half years of researching, they've actually finally managed to identify a Canadian officer.
Lucy told us that. We were up yesterday and she told us about that.
11 and a half years on, and they have finally managed to identify this Canadian officer, and he'll be buried at Lewes later this year.
And have they managed to identify any around here?
There's been quite a few. The problem is Corselet's not a particularly open cemetery anymore because it's full.
That's why they're building the new extension at Lewes.
Exactly. The last couple that have been identified in the area, and I know in about 2016, 2017, two or three sets of Australians were found around Mirko Farm.
Right.
And they were buried into Pozieres British Cemetery.
Their cemetery, yeah.
Yeah. So because this area is quite closed, it's difficult to get burials into cemeteries that are relatively these are small if you compare them to some of the other cemeteries around here, you know. You compare it to Pozieres or to Serre
or Delville
Wood, exactly.
Caterpillar only,
yeah.
And then you can see, you know, the wall, there isn't any space to bury them here. But these men, they'll still come to the surface, won't they? They'll still
absolutely
be found.
And the great thing is as well is they're still re-identifying already buried men through researchers. So there's one specifically that has, it will be rededicated later this year here in the cemetery. And he was a company sergeant major of the 49th.
Right.
And he was one of two possible candidates. And thanks to a researcher, they have actually identified it as one specific.
Because he was an officer.
Because he was a sergeant major.
Sergeant major. Yeah. There was only two of
missing from the 49th on that specific period.
Right.
And a researcher has managed to find, they haven't released what, but it'll be some kind of document that notes that, yes, it's definitely this man over this man.
Because it could be that they found that they've proved that the other man was somewhere
else. Is buried somewhere else or died in the wrong area.
Therefore, it can only be proved by exception.
So, yes, and he's buried on that side of the cemetery. So later on in this year, he will have a brand new headstone with his name.
You'll be here for that,
and
I
will be here for that.
Yeah, it was a 49th Canadian. We'll look at. I know that there are some next week being rededicated up at Hood Crater, which we featured on the podcast a few weeks
ago. And again, it's over 100 years on, and the work is still ongoing.
It will never stop.
It will never stop. No.
Someone me and you know says that the last page of the First World War history will never be turned, will it? We'll quote him.
That's very true.
So, that's fantastic. That really is. And again, just as we're standing here, the shadows are lengthening.
Yeah.
You know, we've been here about half an hour and the sun is starting to go down on what's been a beautiful day.
If you look at somewhere like Corselet, you can't imagine
the
thousands of Canadians that pass through here.
No.
Taking the village.
The building that you live in, was that there in 1914, 1916?
Yes.
Was that used by the Germans?
So this is where it gets a little bit complicated because there's no set documentation.
No.
But within Corselet Village, there are a set of tunnels that predate the First World War by quite a bit.
Right.
And the idea was the tunnels were linking the major farms to the chateaus to the church.
Yeah.
So at a period where France was constantly under threat of attack or invasion, it then meant the important people of the village could be easily evacuated down into the tunnels.
People,
the important people.
Yeah.
The idea being you want to protect the wealthy and your goods as well, because it wasn't just gold and things, it was cloth and animals were your wealth
animals,
then.
Yeah, farms, yeah.
So you had these systems of tunnels that in the end went unused because the furthest they managed to get during the Franco-Prussian War was pretty much to Bapaume.
Right.
So around here
have helped,
it was
would it?
No. So around here it was fairly quiet in the grand scheme of things. Right. But it then meant by the time of the First World War the Germans had these systems of tunnels that were unused but in great condition.
And they
used
couldn't
them.
Believe it when they found them.
And most of the Allied forces had no idea they were
well, they
here.
They wouldn't know, would they?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you were wondering, how did that German manage to get from this side of the village to that side of the village without ever coming up from
the
surface? And my house is one of the farms, because it's one of the biggest farms in the village. Mm. It's not a farm anymore.
No.
But at the time, it was a big fortified farm pre-war, where, before it was destroyed.
Yeah.
So it was basically the last farm in the village that could link from this end to the other end, to the church and the chateau.
Yeah. Is the chateau still there?
No. Unfortunately, the chateau was destroyed completely in 1918 and never rebuilt.
Never rebuilt because the family never came back.
No. They evacuated to Bapaume and then further south during the war and then never came back.
It's like Teatvale, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just exactly the same. Wow, so you're actually living right on top of history, aren't you?
It's weird. And there are rumours, how true these rumours are, that when the Canadians and the British were shelling the village later in 1918, that there were still Germans in the tunnels.
Really?
And the tunnels collapsed. They're not accessible anymore.
No.
They haven't been for over 100 years.
No,
so
they're still there.
So it could well be that there are still some remains underneath many of
these. You're living on top of that?
Yeah. It's all right, the ghosts in the house are quite nice.
Yeah. That is
but
incredible.
Yeah, so, and the village itself is as it was in 1924 when most of it was rebuilt.
In terms of being laid out. Yeah.
The layout is almost exactly as it would have been pre-First World War. Because the idea with the reparations is you had to rebuild like for like.
Which
but of
the Germans
course,
had to pay for.
Of course. But of course the French being themselves, they really over-egged what they needed. They really did.
Yeah.
For example, in my house,
can't
there are three
that.
Versailles marble fireplaces.
Really?
And
were they there before, do you think?
No. And two cast iron ceiling roses.
Oh, right.
So, you
no
know.
No wonder they went bankrupt then.
Yeah. So, but the footprint of the village is pretty much the same as it would have been.
And it doesn't
pre-war.
Look like it's expanded either.
Not hugely,
no,
compared to some others.
There.
There's a couple of new builds, but the village itself has remained sort of within its boundaries.
So quiet. So. No shops, no pubs.
Nope.
No.
Just a quiet farming village.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. And are there any French people whose families were here?
I know that there are families around here who had great-grandfathers and great-uncles who would have been fighting here, certainly in 1915, where you've got battles around
Before we arrived.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When the French were still trying to keep this area under control.
Yeah.
And before then, the British arrived late 1915 and early 1916 to take it over. I know that I get a lot of people asking me about what did the French do on the Somme. And they're always really shocked to find that they were fighting really close to their British allies.
Mm.
They seem to have this assumption the French were far too busy fighting Verdun to be able to...
Well, it's a joint offensive,
troops.
Wasn't it?
Exactly,
we've got a
yeah.
French flag on top of Teatvale.
Exactly. And you'll find French burials all over the place here. I mean, you know, the local biggest cemetery is the French cemetery at Serre, nestled nicely in between Serre Road 1 and 2.
You find lots of French graves within our...
Exactly. Overlers is a classic example.
It is,
We're only a couple of kilometres away.
Yeah,
and you've got men from 1915 and 1916
right.
of the French armies who were buried up there.
Yeah.
So
these will be their grandparents, won't they, of the people that live your neighbours.
Exactly,
Still.
And there's a rich heritage, love of heritage, certainly, for these... Every French village has its own war memorial. Detailing every man that was lost from that village.
Yeah.
And the French really do take an interest in, certainly after the centenary now, certainly, taking more of an interest in family history and their family's military history.
And of course they've grown up, like you have, birth, surrounded, not just by the battlefields, but by these beautiful silent cities, aren't
exactly,
they?
Exactly, yeah. And I've got quite a few of my friends, well, most of my friends are French these days.
Yeah.
And like me, they grew up coming to places like this and they love it.
Really?
Yeah. They're fascinated by
I
it.
I bet.
And very thankful as well.
Really?
Yeah.
That really is lovely to hear, isn't it?
So. There seems to be this odd reputation I've had from some people where the French don't like the British, or the French don't like anyone who's not French, but
no.
You live out here and you can see that they are grateful.
Yeah, well, that's what we've seen.
Yeah.
You know, when in the past when I've got into problems with my car.
Yeah.
You know, I had a puncture and that, and before you know it, there's two French farmers out helping me out. And it happened where we were staying last night when a Dutch girl had a similar problem and the French farmer sorted. We get this all the time when we visit here.
The Somme relies on tourism to survive.
They make us very welcome, don't they?
And this is the thing, if they didn't, there wouldn't be any tourists.
No.
And then the Somme would suffer. And you know, as horrendous as the First World War was, and certainly again for the Second World War, it did pass through here. It's given this area of France the opportunity to rebuild post-war, because they lost so much.
Lost everything.
If you look at somewhere like the Artois region, where you have the mines, they were never rebuilt after the First World War. That section of northern France lost so much.
All that industry went.
And all that industry went, and it was never regained or
and
rebuilt.
And here it's all about farming, isn't it?
Exactly. We are the potato capital of France.
Well, we're everywhere around us as potatoes.
Potatoes everywhere. They're very proud of the fact that we've got potatoes.
Yeah, I'm sure. Terrific. Well, thank you very much, Poppy.
No, it's been a pleasure. Been a
real great one. We enjoyed the ride in your Jeep as well.
Yeah, my lovely little wartime Jeep.
Yeah, thank you. And good luck.
Thank you.
Your ventures.
Thank you. In that cemetery, there are, I think there's 9 special memorials to soldiers that are known to be buried in the cemetery, but whose graves were lost. And it's just one of those that I want to finish with this week. I want to talk about just one of those casualties. And he was Lieutenant John Chilton Mewburn. He was killed in action on that day. He was 23 years old and he was serving with the 18th Battalion. And we have an account here of what happened to him. It says he was wounded while leading his company into the attack on any positions south of Courcelette on the morning of the 15th. But carried on until the objective was reached and the position consolidated. He then left to go to a dressing station, but while on the way he was instantly killed by the explosion of an enemy shell. A Canadian newspaper report gives us more information about this man, and it seems that his father was also a soldier. It says Colonel S.C. Mewburn of the Toronto Military District received a cable yesterday stating that his son, Lieutenant John Mewburn, had been killed in action on the 15th, the date on which the Canadians took so prominent a part in the advance on the Somme. Lieutenant Mewburn, who was the second son of Colonel Mewburn, was an officer in the 13th Royal Regiment in Hamilton, in which unit he received his commission in June 1913. At the outbreak of the war, he wished to enlist for active service at once, but was prevented owing to an operation for appendicitis, which he'd recently undergone. With the call of the 2nd Contingent Units, however, he at once offered his services, and he was given an appointment in the Hamilton Company of the 36th Battalion, with which unit he went overseas in June of 1915. He showed a great adaptability for military work, gaining his Field Officer's Certificate and qualifying also in musketry, bayonet fighting and physical training. From England, he was transferred to the 18th Battalion. He was in his 23rd year and prior to the outbreak of war had been on the staff of the Bank of Nova Scotia, and he was educated at Lakefield and Highfield schools. Just a single man there that I've chosen just to mention as we finish this week's podcast and we play the last post this week in memory of the Canadians and the Germans, those young men that fought and died in the village and in the fields around Courcelette in September of 1916. And we play the last post. Thank you for listening.